Well, good morning. Thank you for joining us. If this is your first time or one of your first times, we appreciate you coming. I know sometimes it's hard to be in a new place, and if you're joining us online, thank you also for being with us. Now, many of you walked in and you saw the bus out in the west parking, and you thought, what is the school bus doing out there? Well, this month, we are highlighting the ministry of Food Fort, and they take that bus 3 days a week, one day in the Clinton neighborhood, one day in the Saratoga neighborhood, one day in the West Lincoln neighborhood, to offer kids there a meal and support in their schoolwork and other things they've got going on in their lives. And, you know, we have talked in the Gospels of Jesus' compassion, particularly for vulnerable people. And these are areas in which people are more vulnerable. And we feel like, boy, they're just doing the hands and feet of Christ. And so, yeah, I encourage you to talk to them. He will be giving a tour of the bus, showing the bus after the second service that is landing out there. So, stop by and see what they're doing. We're encouraged by their ministry in the neighborhood, and perhaps you'd want to partner with what they're doing. You know, we'll let you consider that on your own. So when I was a kid, elementary school, if you wanted to shut something down, like my dad's got this job. I remember I used to collect cards, baseball and football and basketball and hockey cards. And we live in the Detroit area, and I got a Gordie Howe card. He was a great player for the Detroit Red Wings. And I told people, I got a Gordie Howe card. People say, prove it. Prove it. Well, I don't have it on me. Prove it. You don't have it. That, prove it was a way to shut something down. Well, Jesus came and made more ostentatious claims than my dad works in this job or I have a Gordie Howe hockey card. He claimed to be the Son of God. How would prove it work with that claim? That's what I want us to think about today. So if you got a Bible, if you'd open it to Luke chapter 11, we're going to start in verse 14 and go through verse 36, wrestling with this question, does it work like it did in the playground to say prove it to Jesus' claim to be God? If you haven't been with us, we have been in the Gospel of Luke several months now, and we know Luke took on the task of writing an account of Jesus' life for a guy named Theophilus. We believe the Spirit of God kept that account of Jesus' life for us and was revealing Christ through it. And what we've seen is that Jesus was born of a virgin like no other person in the history of the world. God and man come together, fully God, fully human. Was the son of a carpenter, worked as a carpenter for 30 years, and then stepped out into public ministry to begin his ministry, which was eventually to die. And in the process, he showed himself to be the Son of God by doing a number of amazing works beyond human description. And we open with one of those works in verse 14. It says this, and he, Jesus, was casting out a demon, and it was mute. When the demon had gone out, the mute man spoke, and the crowds were amazed. So this guy had been mute. We don't know how long. It had been a while, and he'd been demon-possessed. There was nothing anybody could do. That's just the way it was. Bummer. Until Jesus comes along and speaks a word, and the mute person speaks. The demon is gone, and the crowds were amazed. We don't see that very often. Well, how do you explain that? Well, we get a couple explanations. One in verse 15, but some of them said, he casts out demons by Beelzebul, the ruler of the demons. So Jesus is in working with Satan. He's in cahoots. They're part of a team, and he's doing that in his power. Well, Jesus will deal with that argument in just a couple verses. That was one response. He's doing this by the power of Satan. The other response is verse 16. Others, to test him, were demanding of him a sign from heaven. So he just casts out a demon from a mute person. They want another sign from heaven. It's kind of like, how many signs do you need? Well, Jesus will take down, and he's going to wait a few verses. We'll get to that in verse 29. But right now, Jesus is going to take on the idea that he is doing this as part of Satan's kingdom. Verse 17, but he knew their thoughts and said to them, any kingdom divided against itself is laid waste, and a house divided against itself falls. You can't have infighting and stand. If Satan also is divided against himself, how will his kingdom stand? So imagine U.S. forces, in a design to confuse the enemy, has the Marines shooting at the army. Well, that would certainly be confusing to the enemy, wouldn't it? But we couldn't stand. If we're shooting at each other, the gain we have from confusion is more than offset by the loss of soldiers that are killed. So Jesus is saying this idea that somehow I work for Satan, the loss is going to be far greater than any gain. He says, you say that I cast out demons by Beelzebul. And if I by Beelzebul cast out demons, by whom do your sons cast them out? Remember, Jesus' disciples had been casting out demons. They were Jewish people, and those were their sons. Okay, if I'm casting out by Beelzebul, how about them? Are they in legion with Satan too? So they will be your judges. So Jesus said, I don't think that I'm working in cahoots with Satan is a good answer. I got a better explanation. And he starts it in verse 20, but he says, but if I cast out demons by the finger of God, remember when I'm fixated in elementary school, I could do that with my little finger. I don't need much strength. So he said, with just a modicum of God's strength, I come along and cast out the demon. The conclusion is, then the kingdom of God has come upon you. He gives this example. When a strong man, fully armed, guards his house, his possessions are undisturbed. So I'm the strong guy. I'm got weapons to the max. I'm armed to the teeth, and I got this stuff back here. There's nothing you can do. Until what? Somebody stronger, somebody better armed comes along. Then all that goes away. And that's Jesus' point in verse 22. But when someone's stronger, then he attacks him and overpowers him. He takes away from him all his armor on which he had relied and distributes his plunder. He said, yeah, there was a time Satan, when he possessed somebody, had a hold and there was nothing to be done. But good news, somebody stronger has come along and dispossessed him of that he owned. That's Jesus' explanation. That's what's going on here. God and his authority has showed up. And that's me. Now, the crowd may be taking this all in, but Jesus suggests it's just not enough to know this. This demands a decision. He says this, he who is not with me is against me. He who does not gather with me scatters. Well, I'd like to ride the fence. I'd like to see this. I don't know if I'm fully on board with Jesus or not. He said, I'm not going to allow a middle ground. You're either with me or you're against me. Well, can I be in between? No, there's no in between. You're with me or you're against me. Now, Jesus speaks to this person or people who may have been cleansed of an unclean spirit. Verse 24, when the unclean spirit goes out of a man, it passes through waterless places, seeking and rest and not finding any. It says, I will return to my house from which I came. So I guess these demons are always looking for a place to rest. And when it comes, it finds it swept and put in order. Then it goes and takes along seven other spirits more evil than itself, and they go in and live there, and the last state of that man becomes worse than the first. So somebody is freed from a demon. If there's not a stronger force in them, the demon comes back with friends in tow. The person who is released from a demon must be filled with a sustaining power able to defeat the demon, who will surely come back to look for a place. While Jesus was saying these things, one of the women in the crowd raised her voice and said to him, blessed is the womb that bore you and the breast at which you were nursed. Now, Israel believed that when the Messiah came, that the Messiah would rid the land of unclean spirits. And this woman is putting that together and she's, blessed are you and blessed is the woman who bore you. Jesus has a correction. He says, on the contrary, verse 28, blessed are those who hear the word of God and observe it. You want God's favor? You want to live a life of significance? You want to live a life of abundance? Jesus says, hear the word of God, but just don't hear it. Obey it. Put it in practice. Now in verse 29, Jesus is going to address the part of the crowd that was asking for another sign. He just healed a mute person, cast out the demon, but they still want another sign. It says this, as the crowds were increasing, he began to say, this generation is a wicked generation. It seeks for a sign, and yet no sign will be given to it but the sign of Jonah. For just as Jonah became a sign to the Ninevites, so will the Son of Man be to this generation. Remember, Jonah was called to go to Nineveh. He didn't want to go. He took a ship, was cast overboard, swallowed by a whale, spit up on land. And this is where Jesus is picking up. Jonah did eventually show up in Nineveh. You know what the people did when he came to preach? And this is some foreigner. They repented. Even the king got in sackcloth and ashes. And Jesus' point is, man, if these people would respond to Jonah, how come this generation won't respond to me? Something much greater than Jonah has come along. He gives another example, verse 31. The queen of the south, queen of Sheba, will rise up with the men of this generation at the judgment and condemn them. Why? Because she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and behold, something greater than Solomon is here. It's in the Old Testament. God pours out his favor on Solomon, and this woman hears about it, and she travels a great distance to hear and brings her life in line with what Solomon has to say. Well, again, something much greater has come along, and people are not responding. Verse 32, the men of Nineveh will stand up with this generation at the judgment and condemn it. Why? Because they repented at the preaching of Jonah, and behold, something greater than Jonah is here. All those years ago, Jonah shows up and starts preaching about the kingdom of God, and people change. They turn. He said, I show up the Son of God. I'm doing mighty works. I'm showing myself to be the Son of God, and there's no response. They will face a more severe judgment for that. Jesus said, they have ample evidence. They have every reason to believe I'm the Son of God, and they resist it. See, we started by asking this question, does it work to say, prove it to Jesus' claim to be God? Here's what I'd say. Jesus has given ample evidence showing that he is God. Jesus has given ample evidence showing that he is God. We're not comfortable with the claim and prove it. Well, Jesus has given evidence. Remember on the playground, I've got this hockey card. My dad has this job. Prove it. Why? It's a way to shut it down. Well, they won't work with Jesus because he's given ample evidence. Now, let me say, he doesn't answer every question. Some of you will have questions. You've had sickness. You've had tragedy. And how come? And yeah, all those questions aren't answered. But he has given evidence enough to show he's God. And he has shown in going to the cross and resurrecting from the dead that he is good, that we can trust him. Look, when a judge charges a jury after hearing all the evidence, he says, look for evidence that is beyond a reasonable doubt. What is the most reasonable thing to conclude? Any of you parents out there, did you have a child that just kept asking questions? Come on, keep asking questions. Kid, will you shut up? Keeps asking questions. We had two sons, and we had one who fit that bill. He's sitting right back there at the sound booth back there. And by kindergarten, he is asking questions about the Bible and God. First, young earth versus old earth. Dad, how does that play out? But more importantly, I love the story of the Bible, but how do we know it's true? How do we know it hasn't been changed? Well, initially, he puts these questions to his mother, who courageously says, your father's the pastor. Why don't you ask him? So the question we kept wrestling with was the historical reliability of the scriptures. Finally, in the third grade, I said to him, I said, Drew, who was your kindergarten teacher? And Dad, was Miss Fry. Prove it. There it is. Prove it, right? Prove it. Prove it. Prove it. Well, you can't, because you can't go back and recreate kindergarten. You can't scientifically do that. And he said, well, but ask Miss Fry. Oh, so you're going to build a historical case. Okay. You got anything else? Well, ask this student and this student and this student and this student, because they were in class with me. Okay, that's... Anything else, son? Yeah, Dad, go to the office at Maxie, where I went to school, and they'll have a record that I was in kindergarten with Miss Fry. So, son, you've built a pretty good historical case. Not a scientific case, but a historical case. And I said, but if I'm determined not to believe, and I say to you, can you show me absolutely that you didn't pay off Miss Fry, and can you show me absolutely that you didn't pay off these students, and can you show me that you didn't... You see, if I'm determined not to believe, I can look for an infinitesimal chance that maybe this or that is off. But if I'm looking for what's the most reasonable conclusion, it would be that Miss Fry was your third grade teacher. The next morning, my wife is coming out of the shower out of the bedroom. She hands the paper, March 29, 2011, 7:30 a.m. I asked Jesus into my life. That's on my bulletin board in my office. Evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. A strong historical case that Jesus is the Son of God risen from the dead. He gives us ample evidence to believe that. Now, when people ask questions, we owe them an answer to their question. Here's what Peter says in 1 Peter 3:15. But sanctify Christ as Lord in your heart. I need it. Always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that's in you, yet with gentleness and reverence. People are going to have questions, and those are legitimate, many times legitimate questions. We need to do best to answer the questions. When we don't know, we're not sure, let's tell them that. But what I often found in my years of ministry is people don't have an intellectual problem with God. They have a volitional problem with God. So when I meet with college students, I'd say if I could pose these hypothetical questions, I have video of Jesus coming from the tomb, and I have a notarized statement from God saying the Bible is his word. Would you submit your life to Jesus as recorded in the scriptures? And they would say no, almost every time. I'd say then you don't have an intellectual issue, you have a volitional issue, right? I can't give you enough evidence to convince you. Yeah. So I'd say I'd be interested, and you don't have to answer the question, but what do you think it is volitionally? What is it that you're afraid of in giving your life to Christ? Are you afraid of something you have to give up? Are you going to fear of missing out? Is that what it is? Are you afraid you're not going to be able to do that? What is that? That volitionally is keeping you from coming to Christ. And is it reasonable? Given that he came, he died, and he rose from the dead, that he would hold back from you. I think most people have a volitional issue with Jesus, not an intellectual issue with Jesus. And I certainly think that's the case with the religious leaders who were Jesus' main opposition. They were in control. They had spiritual authority and they had civil authority. You don't cross them. They'll excommunicate you. They can put you in jail. And then here comes this guy doing all kinds of miracles, doing all kinds of crazy. Crowds are gathering. He's a threat to their power. But, you know, Jesus will threaten your power. He will threaten your control as the Son of God. And what are the issues of control in your life? What are the issues of power in your life that you don't want to let go? See, I was a month into my faith. I had come to college to secure my livelihood. My dad had trouble keeping a job, and there's a whole story to that. And I came to Texas A&M, 12 jobs, 6 jobs for every engineer, 12 for chemical engineering and petroleum major. I was a chemical engineering major. And a month in, people said, Andy, you need to turn your career, your major over to God, because ultimately he will provide for you. And I thought, that's the nuttiest thing I've ever heard. That's taken religion too far. Well, over the years, I've seen that to be true. But that's an area, a month into my faith, that I had to give over to God. What are the issues in your life right now that God is calling you to give over to him? So Jesus, as we return to our passage, continues talking about his teaching. Verse 33, he says, no one after lighting a lamp puts it away in a cellar nor under a basket, but on a lampstand so that those who enter may see the light. Look, if there's a dark room and you light a lamp, you don't put the lamp under a basket. No, you put it where it can illuminate. Jesus said, I'm making myself known so people can come to me and trust me. And he's giving out the light, the life of God. Verses 34 to 36, the eye is the lamp of your body. When your eye is clear, your whole body is full of light. But when it is bad, your body is also full of darkness. Then watch out that the light in you is not darkness. If therefore your whole body is full of light with no dark part in it, it will be wholly illuminated as when the lamp illumines you with its rays. The eye is seen as a gate and what gets in. And then when the light gets into the body, Jesus is saying the whole body is full of light. The whole body is full of life. The eye shuts it out, the whole body is dark. Jesus' light has the power to bring life to every part of our life. So sometimes as I've scrolled through Facebook Reels, I click on this one bit. And you know how the algorithm is. The more you click, the more you get. It's a guy named Anatoly. He's a Ukrainian bodybuilder. And he walks into a gym dressed up as a janitor. And he speaks really good English, but he plays his accent up. He makes mistakes with his English, and he's got a hat, and he's got a fake beard and these clothes. And he comes up on these bodybuilders who are lifting hundreds of pounds on a squat and says, "Hey guys, can I jump in with you? I've watched on TikTok and I've learned some good technique." And they look at this guy and it's like, "Are you serious? Are you kidding?" Yeah, and he again, he's a janitor. He said, "I just want to clean. Can I move the bar?" "Dude, you can't lift that bar." "Well," he said, "can I try? Look, you're going to hurt yourself." "Okay, you can try." Then he puts on a couple of more plates, like he's putting on another 100 pounds. And he'll say, "Can you hold the mop?" "Well, the mop is 32 kilograms. It's 70 pounds. So they have trouble with the mop. And then he comes over the bar, and a couple times his hands fly off, and he said, "I'm sorry, just let me try one more time." It's kind of like, "Dude, give it up." And then he pulls that thing up, and he squats three or four. And the guys are aghast. They go, "What's the problem? What's the problem?" And he turns around with the thing, and he's like, "I'm going to move it so I can clean." And it's kind of like, "Dude, who are you?" You know, looking at you, I wouldn't think you're a guy who could squat 400 or 500 pounds, whatever he's doing. How do you do this? He defied expectation. Jesus has come along. "You're just a carpenter, man. You're just a carpenter. And then with the word you cast out demons, and with the word you still a storm, and with the word you raised from somebody from the dead. Who are you, man? Who are you? I'm the Son of God." See, Jesus has given us ample evidence to believe that he is the Son of God.